from PLU, and this one's entitled The Gulf War, Iraq, U.S., and War Crimes. And I want simply to make a few comments and then let discussion roll. They will. I don't have all that much to say of any wisdom about the war, and people have a lot of different thoughts. But I did want to point out a couple of things about the background of U.S. responsibility, and particularly make a few observations about the war crime situation, and hazard one extremely speculative hypothesis. I'll really be going out on a limb. So I'm not going to cover at all a broad moral assessment of the U.S. position in that war, but confine myself to a number of observations about our particular obligations, in particular in relation to war crimes provisions. I'm using the term war crimes in a very broad sense to mean both crimes against peace and war crimes. Now, in the narrower sense, war crimes are things you do in war, not in anything leading up to war. And they include, most importantly, the forbiddance of any deliberate, intentional killing of civilians. And this fits very much with the moral tradition of just-unjust war theory, and it's very difficult to apply because of the notion of intentionality and exactly what, first of all, who's a civilian? Is a factory, is a munitions worker a civilian? Is a munitions worker a civilian when they sleep in their home at night? Would be a classic borderline case. Is one intentionally killing them if one knows ahead of time that the bomb one drops on the city nearby is probably going to kill them, but one wasn't aiming at them in particular? Those are sort of a natural gray area we see. There are some traditions on that, and in particular some traditions of international law on that, as well as moral traditions on that. I think we can note three things in relation to civilians and things of value to civilians here. The international laws of war bar the intentional killing of civilians. They also bar the intentional destruction of what I broadly label civilian infrastructure, or what we might better, more narrowly and more precisely call civilian life infrastructure. This would not be necessarily bombing factories, but it would be the bombing of anything necessary to civilians' lives. Factories, some kinds, can sometimes be necessary to their lives and sometimes aren't. Depends what the factories are making. If it were a milk factory, yes. If it were not, it wouldn't be. And finally, recent additions to the law of war in the Geneva agreements, I think these were added in the 60s, explicitly prohibit the destruction, the intentional destruction of natural resources of a country. Particularly in relation to the latter, it's absolutely clear that the forces of Saddam Hussein in Kuwait committed egregious and clear war crimes in lighting the oil wells at the end. I don't think there's any question about this, and in fact a number of proponents of international law have just wept that such a very clear violation of international law during a war is apparently going to go completely unpunished. Maybe the country would get punished for it in some sanctions type way, you know, not being able to sell their oil for 2 years longer than they would otherwise have been allowed, not allowed to sell their oil or whatever. But it doesn't appear that the particular perpetrators of that crime, either the ones who actually carried it out or those who instructed it, will ever be brought to international justice. There is also a qualification on some of these, though it's usually it would be a matter of or, intentional or, another qualification, wanton. Killing of civilians, intentional or wanton destruction of civilian life infrastructure, or intentional or wanton destruction of natural resources. Even if one could show that one's destruction of, say, natural resources wasn't intentional, if it was wanton, and in the context of international laws of war, what that would mean is serves no plausible military purpose, then even if it wasn't intentional, if one foreknew about it ahead of time, that this is what was going to be involved, then it would, then the lack of intentionally aiming at that destruction would not get one off the hook. One would still be on the hook if, though one's destruction of natural resources weren't intentional, it was of no conceivable military value. Now, Saddam Hussein's forces in Kuwait, I think, are hung on both, both because of the wantonness, even if it wasn't intentional, and because it was, I think, also clearly intentional destruction of natural resources. So it's a particularly clear case of the violation of the laws of war. Now, the U.S., the possible charges of war crimes against the U.S. are a little trickier, but and to get at them, we need to do a little more work on intentionality, and in particular, I think, sort of a moral sense about the work on intentionality. It has come to be a certain kind of moral custom about this, and even, I think, pretty clearly crept into some legal, international legal understandings, too. And for those of you who've done any theological ethics or even philosophical ethics, you'll know the principle of double effect. It gets its name by just simply distinguishing between foreknown side effects and intended, intentionally aimed at means or ends. Take the example of the bombing, the atomic bombing at Hiroshima. One might say, well, we can get off the hook there by saying that we were aiming at a military installation downtown. Well, in fact, though one might actually, one might conceivably, this could be historical truth, one might have actually aimed the bomb at a military installation in downtown Hiroshima, that it's not a plausible interpretation of American strategy, remotely plausible interpretation of American strategy, to say we were not intentionally aiming at civilians. One could argue that we were only, that we just knew that if we intentionally dropped that bomb on the military installation in downtown Hiroshima, that we would kill 100,000 civilians, but that's not what we were intentionally aiming at. Now, one would be automatically suspicious of that. I think we can explicitly disprove that excuse that we were only aiming at the downtown military installation by drawing a distinction between intentional means and intentional ends. Even if we were not intentionally aiming at the producing the 100,000 deaths, civilian deaths in Hiroshima, we were still, because we foreknew that that there would be large civilian losses, given where we were aiming the bomb, even if it was at a military installation in downtown Hiroshima, the civilian losses that we were aiming at, though they might not have been our end, were a means toward another end, and they were intentionally devised as a means toward our end, namely strategic terror. They were strategic terror bombing to try to force the Japanese government to surrender. And the test here of whether or not it's an intentional means is simply whether or not you can say to your, whether or not it's true, that if, by some miracle, in dropping the bomb on the downtown military installation, 100,000 residents of Hiroshima had not died, civilians, residents of Hiroshima had not died, would your whole purpose in dropping this bomb have been destroyed? would your purpose have been defeated? And in fact, the U.S. purpose would have been defeated. Even if we'd taken out the military installation, if the 100,000 civilians hadn't been killed, our military purpose would have been defeated, because our military purpose went through the civilians, so to speak, to get at the Japanese government. Maybe even a clearer case of this was the terror bombing by the largely British, and to a very small extent the U.S. in World War II, where we explicitly, where the British said, if we kill enough German civilians, the German people will stop supporting the central government in Germany, and this war will end more quickly. Now, the British may have had nothing against German civilians, but they were certainly using German civilians as a means to try to accomplish their military end, the quicker survival of the German government, the surrender of the German government. So it's not just whether or not the ultimate end you had was killing a civilian or destroying the environment or destroying civilian life infrastructure. It's whether or not you were also perhaps using it as an intentional means to accomplish another, your ultimate end, which was a legitimate military end. So the means can become illegitimate because of the of what they constitute, namely civilians being killed, even when the military ends aren't. Now, in relation to the U.S., well, let me back up for a minute. One might say, why in the world would one ever support a principle like that? If you know 100,000 people are going to die, then even if, excuse me, back up a minute. Let's take a different example in Hiroshima, because there it's clear that there that you are intending the deaths of tens of thousands of civilians at least. That's your strategy. The strategy of using the atomic bomb wouldn't work if there wasn't huge civilian loss involved in it. Take a different example where you drop a bomb on a munitions plant outside of a German city in World War II, and you know that it is very likely going to cause some civilian deaths, but it's not, but you claim that you're not aiming at those civilians. Either aiming at them as your ultimate end, nor are you aiming at them as a means to accomplish your military strategy. That is, if by some chance, when you drop that bomb on that munitions factory, all the workers were gone, and let us say, and to make it an extremely clean example, no one in the surrounding residential area got injured, much less killed, but you completely took out the munitions plant. If you could say to yourself, you said to yourself, well, I've accomplished the mission of this bombing, then that shows that if civilians had been killed by your bombing, those killings were only foreknown civilian deaths, not ones you intended, because they weren't essential to your strategy. They were completely irrelevant to your strategy, in fact, though you knew that it was likely that significant numbers of civilians would get killed. If you can say that, then the traditional defenders of this principle would say, those civilian losses that might occur if you actually drop the bomb are merely foreknown side effects, and you're not guilty for having caused them. Though you did cause them, and though you knew that they would likely happen, you're not guilty for having caused them, at least not legally guilty in any internationally moral, universally moral sense, because those civilian deaths were not either your intended end or your intended means, and intended means that was an ingredient in your strategy. Now, in response to that, somebody might say, well, how in the devil can it be wrong, right, to kill 1,000 civilians when we know that that's likely going to happen and we are causing the killing just because we don't intend the killing of those civilians as either a means, part of our military strategy, or as our ultimate end. We still are causing it, those civilian deaths. We know those civilian deaths are going to result. We're not off the hook. In response to that, I think there's a very common sense kind of revision of the principle of double effect that is the only way you can save this principle at all. This is not my revision at all. It's Michael Walzer's revision, a noted writer in this field. And it goes this way, that if you drop a bomb on the town and that particular strategy for taking out the munitions plant was the strategy that minimized civilian deaths compared to alternate strategies that also could have worked militarily, then you're off the hook. But suppose an alternate military strategy was to send commandos in to blow up the plant internally instead of dropping a bomb on it with the risk of killing various civilians. And that alternate strategy of sending in commandos did not risk defeating the whole venture. That is, it stood, though not perhaps quite as good a chance of success still a very plausible chance of success, and you weren't dooming your military venture by resorting to the commando strategy instead of dropping the aerial bomb. If that's the case, then you're obligated to drop, to use the commando strategy instead of drop the aerial bomb, even at some risk to your own combatants. Because after all, civilian lives are more valuable than combatant lives. Even your own combatant lives should be risked first before endangering enemy civilian lives. That is simply the law of war on this matter of drawing a distinction between civilians and combatants. You may not excuse the killing of civilians on the other side, even if you didn't intend those killings, either as a means or an end, if there's an alternate way you could have done your constructed your military strategy, which, and even if that alternate way would have killed more of your own combatants, as long as the number of your own combatants that it risked killing, the alternate way, doesn't doom the venture to start with. Now, in some cases, using the commando strategy to blow up a munitions plant is going to be foolhardy. The chance of its success is very small. You might have to try 40 times before you succeeded. In the meantime, you would have lost 40 of your top commando squad people, and maybe though it's too late in the war for the blowing up of the plant to accomplish any good. That would be a case where you'd be still justified in dropping the aerial bomb. So there's a further test here that sort of tests out the commitment of the perpetrator of whatever act is being talked about, the sincerity of their commitment to preserve civilian life in the face of possible combatant losses. It's that you must be willing to risk some of your own combatant lives to minimize enemy civilian losses. Otherwise, what difference does this civilian combatant distinction make at all? We will choose means which we know will minimize our combatant losses, even if they run huge civilian losses on the other side, and excuse those by simply saying, well, we would have been happy if the civilian losses on the other side had been minuscule. We just didn't want to risk any of our own combatant lives. Bombing downtown Baghdad to take out military installations. Yes, we would have been perfectly happy if we would have found out not a single Iraqi civilian had been killed. But the point would be, by proponents of the revision, that no, you're still not off the hook, unless the strategy of bombing downtown Baghdad was a strategy that minimized civilian losses compared to alternatives that still could have succeeded militarily for you. Now, at that point, I think the U.S. really gets on the hook. We were under, I would hazard the following political observation, that given the Vietnam War, and given the political realities of domestic U.S. politics, both the military commander, both the Pentagon and the Bush administration were terrified of even U.S. combatant losses in the range of 1,000 or 2,000, much less 10,000. And so they were willing to cause, in foreknown fashion, we knew that it would cause this, cause tens of thousands of Iraqi deaths, civilian deaths, people who are supposed to be off limits, in order to save even 500 U.S. combatant lives. But if that's what we're doing, then we've simply said an enemy civilian is worth very little compared to our own combatants. It's not that we've said an enemy combatant may be killed, lots of them, to save our combatants. It's that we've said enemy civilians, lots of them, may be killed to save our combatants. And on that score, some of the bombings, not all by any means, because not all posed great dangers to civilian life in Iraq, but some of the U.S. bombings, I think, could be charged as violations of the international law not to attack civilians. Which ones? Well, I'd have to know a lot more about which particular plants were located where, with what likelihood of killing civilians, how securely we knew they were military targets, what the alternate strategies were by which we could have destroyed those targets, without risking civilian lives as much, and furthermore, the question whether you even needed to take that target out to have a good chance of winning, a very high chance of winning when we attack Kuwait. Now, on that score, I think one observation might be that we simply didn't need to bomb anything north or south of the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. If we had just stuck in the area between the rivers, we could have been assured that there would be no resupplying, virtually no resupplying of the Iraqi forces in Kuwait, and we would have won the war virtually as quickly. So there's a very, very small, very, very marginal gain to U.S. forces in having extended the bombing somewhat north and somewhat south of those two rivers. Furthermore, why do we bomb virtually all, 90% is the figure I've seen, of the electric utility plants in Iraq, rather than selectively bombing the ones that we thought were crucial to the transport of, to the communications centers? Well, you can say we had to take them all out because otherwise they could have rewired things to get their electricity from another area. We could instead perhaps have, but this is all, I mean, it would presuppose some extra military testimony to be sure, but these are the kinds of things that would have come, could have come up in a war crimes tribunal, a trial of U.S. Strategists and commanders here. The sanitation and water facilities, I think, are even a more problematic case. And the bridges, the extent, the number of bridges we bombed in the Baghdad area, rather than bombing just bridges down closer to Kuwait, which were just as essential. If you bombed those, there's no way they could have gotten reinforcements in. Did you need to bomb all the ones around Baghdad? And then we also get into the water and sanitation facility. And I would guess that, in fact, this is my extremely wild speculation, that perhaps, this is pure speculation, perhaps if we had captured Saddam Hussein and put him up for war crimes trials for destroying the oil in Kuwait as well as other things, we would have had to face some war crimes possibilities ourselves. And we didn't want to touch that sort of thing, so it was just as well that we not try Saddam Hussein. I don't know whether any of that entered into any U.S. strategist's mind, but I would put the point more cautiously by saying, in fact, U.S. behavior does raise a plausible charge of war crimes. Therefore, it's not just Saddam Hussein, but conceivably us who would have been on the block of any international trial, in the dock at any international trial. Let me hazard one more observation about the background of this. It seems to me morally, this isn't a legal principle at all, I don't think, in international law, though it is sometimes in domestic law. Even if technically you're clean in your behavior when a crisis actually comes, if you're responsible for the crisis having developed somewhat, though another person was even more responsible for it having developed, you share some responsibility to try to minimize the catastrophic losses in the way you respond to the crisis. So that if, in fact, we were extremely negligent in not warning Iraq not to invade Kuwait when we had signals that they might, the whole April Glaspie business in the 2 weeks before, as well as our complicity in not raising a single finger about, in fact, the Bush administration's opposition to some senators who were trying to raise fingers about Hussein's gassing of several Kurdish villages. We might be seen as having given a green light to Hussein. If that's true, then we bear even greater responsibility for making sure that our behavior is clean once we respond to the admitted aggression and crime against peace that Hussein committed when he marched into Kuwait. That's not a legal point, that's strictly, I think, a moral point about our responsibility there. So far from this being a clean war, I see it as another example, as almost every war is, of one with a lot of moral nuances and guilt and responsibility on both sides. Even that's not in any way excusing what Saddam Hussein did. Okay, that's the end of my remarks.
I have a question, maybe we could go just before the war. So the agreement of the United Nations that gave authority to bomb or to attack the Iraqis. It's my understanding that in the legalese of the UN, that you had to have for an agreement of the Security Council members, you had to have agreement or consent by all members of the Security Council in order to attack a given member of the United Nations. And my understanding was that China abstained from voting, and that there might be some, there actually was a little bit of illegality there that Bush is taking charge at that point. I don't think we heard too much about this at all.
I've heard that charge too. A political scientist on our faculty says it's simply mistaken, that the Charter of the UN says that no responsive force action may be taken against aggression without the consent of the Security Council according to its normal procedures. But its normal procedures don't count abstentions as vetoes. You have to positively veto to stop. So that as long as China didn't veto, the abstention means nothing. And I don't know whether he's right, but that's at least the reading of, we'd have to actually go to the Charter to
The fact that we were, according to a news, so feared that the missiles were going to force Israel to enter the war, and that's one thing that we didn't want to do politically. Would that be an excuse for bombing Baghdad, where we figured or had ideas that those missiles were
to try to take out a higher percentage of the missile of the? Of Iraq's missile installations? Yes, if it doesn't risk civilian lives that much more than alternative strategies for taking out those missile sites. Or if taking out the missile sites is not necessary to an overall military strategy that brings the war to a quick conclusion and minimizes general losses.
Had we not taken them out in retrospect, very likely Israel would have created much more damage than we did had they been induced to protect themselves.
As I understand it, most of the bombing that we did in the 30 days, was it 30 days before? No, more than that, 40 days before the actual ground response, was aimed not at those missile installations. I mean, quite a bit was, but it was primarily aimed at communications networks and at disabling, or just removing completely the ability of Iraqi society relating to the military to respond in any long-term battle that might eventuate in Kuwait if the Iraqis were able to hold out long enough for reinforcements and things like that to become even militarily relevant. So, I wouldn't want to put any, I just don't know at all anything about the missile installation response, but the justification for bombing the sewage and water systems and all the utility plants in the way we did was simply to prevent any Iraqi army from staying remotely organized if we had gotten into any kind of long-term battle. And, of course, taking out communications networks is crucial even in a short term, a very, very short war. Didn't mean to ignore the first question here before.
Well, I was just thinking that overkill on the bridges, isn't this a demoralizing effect without taking human lives or civilian lives?
Well, no, they did.
Rationalize that?
We bombed the one bridge at 4 o'clock in the afternoon when it had civilians on it. Civilians are going to be on the bridge at almost any time, but if we had wanted to minimize civilian losses, given the technology we supposedly have, we could have taken it out tonight.
Were we given all this information in the press?
Oh, yeah. The 4 p.m. bombing of one of the downtown bridges in Baghdad was in the newspapers and immediately raises the question of whether or not it would be there. Now, it's the fact that we didn't think hard about those things. I don't think we thought hard about them for those things. I don't see how we could have bombed that bridge at 4 p.m. in Baghdad, all those bridges, when we did, if we had thought hard about it. Just shows that when you get in the fervor of war, your first sight is on winning that war as quickly as possible. But the international laws of war do not say it is legitimate to use a particular strategy just because that will win you the war the quickest. There are limits within how quick you can win it, what means you can use to win it quickly. And the most important limit is effects either immediate or long-term on civilians. There's also, of course, what I haven't mentioned is the controversy about how many lives the bombing of the water and sanitation facilities is actually going to, civilian lives are going to be lost by that in Iraq. Initial fears are something like 160,000, 200,000 if the heat was really bad this summer and disease spread. And a recent article I saw said that they were now revising the even worst case estimates, probably around 100,000. But the best case estimate would be already 5,000 civilian.
What's the record in the history of war crimes trials?
That's the other question here is when are there ever trials other than by victors? In prejudicial fashion. There was a lot of controversy even after World War II with as egregious an opponent as Nazi Germany and Japan about whether or not there should also have been war crimes trials of certain Allied personnel. But the main one would have been Commander Harris. In Britain, the head honcho behind the British terror bombing of civilian cities. Clearly, you could have had a war crimes trial of Commander Harris. The problem there was that Churchill explicitly gave him the go-ahead for all that stuff, though Harris was the person strongly pushing it. So you couldn't have tried Harris without trying Churchill for complicity, and it was completely out of the realm of political conceivability to try Churchill.
The wartime trials is just a mockery, isn't it? It's nothing. It has no historical basis, and it has no moral, actually, when you come right down to who's a winner. The loser might be the fellow that didn't start the war.
One observation one might make in the long run here is that war crimes trials have very little hope of ever containing conduct of war within reasonable boundaries. For several reasons, one of which is almost always the party who's committed the most egregious war crimes will also have committed some war crimes, and once one tries the most egregious side, then one is going to be opening oneself up to crimes oneself. Therefore, even the just victor, assuming we have that the victor is the just side, even the just victor won't prosecute the most egregious crimes on the other side for fear of opening up the can of worms in one's own behavior. The other, I think, reason for doubting their effectiveness in the long run is precisely what you heard being argued about heatedly before our response either on January 15th or February 22nd started. Namely, whether we should, especially in the buildup before. No, this wouldn't be applicable after January 15th. In the buildup of various diplomatic pressures before January 15th, Bush sort of shut up about the war crimes trial threat. He initially stated it in December, I think, and then he soft-pedaled it. And as if not to want to appear to Saddam Hussein to be saying, even if you give in now, we're going to try you.
Yeah.
because then there's no chance he'll give in before January 15th. And so there's negotiating pressures on not even mentioning the threat of trying a person for war crimes. Now, that doesn't hold if the person then actually, if we come to battle and the war is actually fought and the other person is defeated, then you haven't lost any diplomatic leverage if you try them for war crimes. Then the barrier is no longer loss of diplomatic leverage, but your own possible complicity for other things.
But even then, there's still the, you know, like they were talking about, how do we know when we've won? And so they were still really, we're negotiating with him over the terms of ending the war, even at the end. And
we could have made availability to be a defendant at a war crimes trial part of the condition of their surrender.
Which was very...
And we didn't.
Even at that point, you know, the same argument still existed that they would have been very unlikely to have ever agreed.
That's true.
To a settlement, even as lopsided as the negotiating was at that point. So this seems kind of like the philosophers of the world kind of going off on their own track here, Paul. I mean, what is the point of talking about war crimes when...
Oh, they're a very significant lever in the world's discussion. I mean, one of the levers on which the U.S. and the nations in the U.N. that's sided with the U.S. and responding to Hussein was that he's already committed war crimes, a crime against peace and marching into Kuwait, and that sort of thing ought to be stopped. So you use war crimes talk or crimes against peace talk even if you don't say you're going to hold trials. And then when we get to the actual ecocide in Kuwait, the lighting of the oil wells, I mean, I think there really is at least somewhat a very plausible argument that anybody whom you can get your hands on who's committed things like that ought to be tried. Because the potential for that in the future, I mean, crimes against or destruction of natural resources has occurred many times in the history of war, but this one was, I think, particularly egregious. I mean, what did Iraq have to gain by lighting Kuwait's oil wells? It was very intentional and completely wanton destruction of natural resources. Isn't there a need to, when you get sort of the first really crystal clear example of that in modern history, and there's a clear international legal convention against it,
to everybody in the world,
shouldn't you try
having a trial? Everybody knows it's crystally clear, as evil as you get. So
no, to dissuade future, you know, the same reason that you have trials in other cases, at least in part, to dissuade future war criminals from doing the same sorts of things, the same sort of ecocidal.
But has anyone waged a war according to the international laws of war and stuck to them?
Well, nobody's ever waged a war, I think, that completely stuck to them. But there's certainly lots of things, I think, that nations haven't done because there are lots of wars. The wars could have been even worse. I'm not giving any defense here of the unjust war theory or international law necessarily. Still, the outcome might be so bad that we wouldn't want to buy it. We would think that the destruction is still likely so bad that we have very great difficulty approving of wars, even in response, but response to aggression. But certainly the laws of war have kept some nations from doing some even worse things. That was, I think, particularly true of World War II and probably of Vietnam, too. I mean, the destruction we wrecked on Vietnam was terrible, but it might have been a lot worse if it hadn't been for international laws.
I was just wondering, you know, while we're using those, if our administration and then us aren't guilty, perhaps, of the revised principle of double effect, because once we knew that those those oil wells are in danger. But that was not a surprise when those oil wells were lit on fire. They warned that they were going to do that. And we knew that before we ever dropped a bomb, while we were still in negotiation. And so aren't we, even if it is unattended, perhaps can be indicted, you know, for having complicity in that. Now we know in our own legal system, if two men go in to rob a bank, and the police interrupt the bank robbery, and the police shoot one of the men, that other robber is charged with murder, because it's a conspiracy.
The other robber is also trying to rob the bank, and we weren't trying to light oil wells in Iraq. We might not have done as much as we could have to prevent it.
Two little brothers get into a fight. You know that either one of them could get hurt, and they're both guilty of being in a fight. I'm wondering, you know, how can you ever, how can you really defend military action when you have clear-cut alternatives? You know, this was not a case of the Two Kingdoms theory, a justifiable war. I saw several of you that you have a checklist of about 8 conditions that apply, and if it meets all these, then you have a justifiable war. And it's arguable that if our government, our people, met one of those conditions.
Well, I think there's a plausible case to be made that short of the civilian, of not targeting civilians in Iraq itself, that in fact we met all the conditions. But you have to look at history in a certain way to argue that. There was clearly aggression by Iraq.
Not against us.
Against Kuwait, but the traditional just war theory doesn't say it has to be against us. It says it has to be against a victim who has not provoked the aggression. You get into a controversy about whether Kuwait provoked the aggression. But assuming they didn't, at least not enough to let Iraq off the hook, then Iraq's still the aggressor. And an aggressor can call upon other nations to help defend it, as long as those other nations go through proper procedures in making their own decision whether to help the victim of aggression. That's the general outline of the theory. And it seems to me on that count, the legitimate procedures in responding to aggression, the U.S. is pretty clean, although clearly Bush is not announcing his offensive strategy until November 8th, 2 days after the election, is a very morally suspicious element in that background. But the Bush administration could also argue that this was a proportional response, that is, that the other responses would have been even worse in the long run. And so I don't necessarily believe all those claims, but the U.S. position meets the outlines of international notions, which are pretty much a derivative of just unjust war theory, of a justified response to aggression. The one area where I think we just don't meet it is this demand that we not expose civilians on the enemy side to unnecessary destruction. Intentional. I just don't think we could make the case that we've satisfied that part of the just war theory. So even on the most, even just taking that theory without any question, which a lot of people wouldn't, we still get ourselves in. We still are in trouble.
The enemy has impressed civilians into their armed forces. I don't see how you can make a clear.
No, that's their
combatants and. Civilian.
Well, in this case, yeah, they've got the further question of whether or not it's a real serious moral question of whether you should go out to destroy an army, almost all of whose members are unwillingly in that army, like theirs. It raises another whole huge question. But even if we were clean on that, we'd still have this problem of aiming at civilians. Directly aiming at them, but not, because we probably are clean on the traditional principle of double effect. It's just that the traditional principle of double effect is not one I think any of us would really want to buy. People and nations are under some obligation to minimize the foreknown bad side effect losses that they cause, even if they're clean in not having intended them. And so there's a further moral standard that you have to meet, and it seems to me that unless we heard some further, rather surprising, very surprising, military explanation of why bombing all those bridges and all those other things were necessary to the success of our venture, not necessary to keeping our military losses down to 246, but necessary to the military success of our venture, we stand convicted by our behavior, as not as much as Iraq, but in a way that is still clearly wrong internationally. Gordon?
Well, I was just going to say that given the outcome and the fact that we probably won't know how many people have died in Iraq with Hussein still in power, maybe another reason why he's still there. To me, I don't define it as a war. It was a battle, because you don't see outcomes that disproportionate in war. And you could probably find some battles, the Little Bighorn, for one, and other battles in history like that. So this, to me, is a new kind of war, very, very new, that we're facing with what you're describing as really old rules. Another example would be in Latin America, or perhaps all over the world in our case, with our use of low-intensity warfare. And most of us, I think, understand that term. Maybe you can, or someone can define it better than I can, but where are the rules?
Well, precisely one of the arguments against not only certain kinds of guerrilla warfare, but certain kinds of responses to guerrilla warfare is that we intentionally endanger civilians in the process of responding more than is necessary for military success. So this framework is not necessarily impotent in when confronted with new kinds of warfare like that. What one does when one goes into a village in a counter-guerrilla war, as in Vietnam, is, can be measured by these. Yeah, by this standard, and the U.S., at least in many cases, comes off pretty badly when measured by the very just unjust war principles that it claims should regulate
Well, take
war.
The one incident in Baghdad in which they shoot the laser rocket into the shelter in which civilians have been moved into.
We claimed it was a communication.
So, and we're not mass bombing, but we still have that incredible technology to be able to pinpoint this thing. Oh, we made an error. We made an error.
I think by the usual notions of legal responsibility, that is not one that is very likely to hang us.
Right.
We're much more likely to be hung by some of the bridge bombing and the bombings of the water and utility and the sanitation facilities than we are by that one. I'm not saying I'm not saying it was the right thing to do.
No.
But there are levels and degrees of
I'm
responsibility.
Do the rules still work? Doesn't seem like they do.
Well, the question of whether the rules work in practice is one thing. Maybe they don't. The question of whether the rules are still should still provide some rhyme and reason to the way we make condemning and approving judgments about nations' behaviors is another thing. And nations are going to go on making condemnations of acts of war even if they don't do anything to prohibit those those acts. And part of what I guess I'm, even if we're not talking about realistic possibility of war crimes trials here or anything, I would argue a nation should still be consistent in its talk. And if we're going to use just war theory to condemn Iraq and justify our own response to their aggression, then we've got to live up to the theory in other respects too. And you can't just bomb a bridge because it's
bridge.
It seems to be easy to do.
What mystified me is why he sat still so long to let us build up to a 500,000 people and then let us start the war. If he was really going to be our enemy other than our oil enemy, why did, logic doesn't prevail there at all.
Unless it's some sort of master strategy to provide us with such an easy victory that we don't go after him in the final analysis, and then we...
I happen to be at school studying a lot of what was going on in international law in the midst of what was going on in Iraq, and working with some people who were experts in their field on Middle East studies. And for Saddam Hussein to have backed down once the demand was made by the Western, mainly Western countries, that he leave, and that Iraq leave, for him to back down would have been political and probably corporal suicide for him. It, you know, he could not, in his country, back down to a Western heathen. I mean, you know, you take all these religious factors and political and, you know, these kinds of factors into it, by the January 15th date, and in circles of these experts that I was working with, it was commonly hypothesized, if nothing else, that he would offer some sort of peace treaty January 17th, once that date had passed, so that he could say, I'm not under their rules, of their deadlines. And so it was kind of a thing that he couldn't back down, but that people really kind of were expecting him to back down 2 or 3 days later. I wonder if George Bush and people in the administration weren't aware of that, that cultural, those factors as well, and if Bush wasn't intentionally, you know, using this for other purposes, and what we can give him so long. So that, but, that is one explanation that I heard. But
we wanted to prove our military point once that January 16th deadline hit,
well,
and not wait 1 second, because we had another whole larger world agenda about the military point.
Are we not now the world's military power? What, you know, was the real military objective?
That could easily be. I'm not questioning that at all.
It has more to do with the world.
Well, I wonder too. I mean, if President Bush and the administration had known of these kind of cultural factors, I'll call it, the life of life, isn't that, if they had known that, wouldn't it also be a violation of the UN treaty, I think Article 52, that says that if you are to use force against another member of the UN, then you must do anything and everything necessary to prevent the action in the first place. And if he had known about this, then it seems like,
or simply calling him by his first name instead of President Hussein all the time, which is an insult to
an
Iraqi.
An aggressive response.
Provokes.
Ever since, you know, Iraq invaded Kuwait, we had reacted aggressively toward them. I didn't see valid proposals for peace or valid negotiations. Not that we had to give in, but that we had to make an effort through the United Nations, or as North Americans, we had most of the people, soldiers there, to make, to arrange or reach an agreement that would have prevented the...
Well, generally, the crime itself is not negotiable, though. The aggression itself is not negotiable. And I don't think there's anything, the U.S. didn't do anything wrong in just demanding that Iraq get out of Kuwait.
But before a country can attack an aggressor, you have to do anything and everything necessary. Isn't that part of how the treaty reads?
That's right.
In order to...
But one of the things that we were not obligated to try were proposals that would allow him to stay somewhat in Kuwait. We are not obligated to try those negotiating avenues, assuming that what he did take in Kuwait was aggression. Now, there may be some disputes about the oil field business, and that certainly.
Yeah, I'm not arguing that we should have given him anything or given Iraq anything, but I think that we should have been willing to approach the table to get out of this peacefully, and I don't think that was ever done, and I think that the intent there was...
Yeah, I don't think... We just don't know what Saddam Hussein would have done if we had been a little more flexible or a little less irritating in our own rhetoric, irritating to him in our own rhetoric, if we hadn't called him Saddam, or how did he Saddam, that's the word.
And that's
if Bush hadn't called him Saddam, and if
that's a bad word in their language.
Yeah. But had called him President Hussein instead, which is sort of the first obligation of heads of state in even trying to get out of a war in which the other side is clearly an aggressor. And if we had waited till January 18th, would he have given in? We'll never know. I mean, his foolishness in putting that army so exposed into Kuwait to begin with makes one wonder what whether he would have been any more sane in those if we had treated him politely and had given him a few more days in January. But you're absolutely right. There is an obligation to make the attempt.
One comment about that. I mean, sure, I think George Bush probably fanned the flames a bit, but turn it around and some of the rhetoric that was coming from Iraq was certainly inflammatory. You know, the great Satan was thrown about many, many times. I guess that's my comment. And my question is the possibility of a trial on war crimes now out of the question? I mean, would it have to have been a part of the negotiated capitulation in order to
No, it's still possible. I don't think the U.S. will ever carry it out. I think the reason we won't is there will be some other hard questions that will come very much to the surface.
Why is it up to the U.S.?
About our own behavior.
Why? I mean, this was a U.N. sort of an action. I mean, at least on the.
The other U.N. parties have followed our lead. They may have backed us completely sincerely, but they are not about to take the lead on this stuff at all. I don't think even Britain and France are like
that. In terms of international law of war, if it's so...
Well, you might say it's available in the very worst, cleanest cases. But this wasn't a clean case, because we weren't clean.
Is it possible to try a sovereign who's still in power?
Sure. If you can get your hands on him.
But you can't force him to come to an international court.
No, you'll have to go take it.
But you probably know this, but I mean, war crime certainly isn't the only level of international law. I mean, you know, international courts are in fact settling lots of disputes and becoming more and more
That's
powerful.
Right. Yeah, we don't want to condemn all of international law just because we think war crimes trials are very unlikely ever to happen. I think it's interesting. We had a certain confidence in the world in the 1950s, and even I think in the 1980s about the possibilities of trying people for war crimes. We had even tried Lieutenant Calley, though it was on domestic U.S. military grounds, for things that were indirectly connected with the definitions of war crimes and international law. We just said it was by our own law that those became part of U.S. law, and he was technically tried by a U.S. court, of course. But after that experience of a nation trying its own war criminal, and after Nuremberg and the Tokyo trials, there was, I think, some expectation that there would be some trials here. But even if we got our hands on them, I'm not sure we'd push to try them in this case. So maybe the whole war crimes trials business just is a much more impotent instrument in regulating the behavior of nations in war than people have thought. It's five. We should have. Thank you for all your comments.